The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to Hour 1 of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 14th day of June, after which I'll hand it off to Raymond Mora for Hour number 2. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in one of the 1969 Miracle Mets. Art Shamsky will join us. In the second half, we'll talk to former Houston Astros pitcher J.R. Richard about his very compelling story. He has a new book out titled Still Throwing Heat, Strikeouts, the Streets, and a Second Chance. So sit back and relax and enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page, cleverly titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by and give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter, at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, hey, all you daily sports fantasy players out there. Sports Talk 1240 is teamed up with a new daily fantasy sports website. That's called DraftPots.com. So go over to DraftPots.com and register with the promo code SportsTalk1240. There you'll receive a free $5 credit to get you started. So head right over there, DraftPots.com. Use the promo code SportsTalk1240. You'll get $5 credit, and there you go. Get yourself started for daily fantasy sports. Well, my first guest was an outfielder, first baseman during his major league career that saw him play for the Cincinnati Reds, the Chicago Cubs, the Oakland A's, and, of course, we know him as a member of the New York Mets, especially the 1969 World Series champion Miracle Mets, the team that won the hearts of a city and a country. And it's hard to believe that it's 46 years ago. We remember it like it was yesterday. Welcome to Sports Talk 1240. Art Shamsky. Art, good evening.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks.
Great to have you, Art. Now, Art, you grew up in St. Louis. Now, I wonder if I should assume that you rooted for the Cardinals when you were a kid.
I was a big Cardinal fan. My hero was Stan the Man Musial, a great player and Hall of Famer, and I was glued to the radio and the TV whenever the Cardinals were playing, and grew up, a terrific Cardinal fan. It was interesting that when I signed a contract with the Cincinnati Reds, everybody said, "Well, I could have signed with the Cardinals." Back then, there was no draft, and they were interested in me. But it was interesting. I just wanted to get away from home, and I wanted to go out on my own a little bit. So that's what I decided to do, but the Cardinals were my team as a kid growing up.
Okay, now, you attended University City High School in St. Louis. You played on the baseball team there, and so did a guy named Kenny Holtzman. You were a few years ahead of Kenny, though. Did you know him in high school?
Yeah, I did. I knew his family, and Kenny was a little behind me, but he was a terrific high school pitcher and then a college pitcher at University of Illinois, and then of course, he went on to having a really terrific major league career. I believe he pitched 2 no-hitters, if I'm not mistaken, and we've been friends for a very, very long time. But he was a great pitcher in high school and, of course, in the big leagues also.
We're speaking to Art Shamsky tonight. Now, you played for the University of Missouri in 58-59. Then you were signed by Cincinnati as a free agent. Were there any other clubs that were after you, or was it just Cincinnati?
No, I could have signed with 9 or 10 teams. I chose Cincinnati. It's kind of crazy. They were a really good team back then, of course. And I liked the uniforms. Believe it or not, I liked the uniforms. They had the cut sleeves, not that my arms were that big. I had those skinny arms that didn't look great in that uniform. But I don't know. I just liked it. And they were really good to me. I got a chance to work out with them at Busch Stadium on the field as a kid. And the other teams were interested in me, too, also. But it wasn't about money. It was just that I liked them. They were great to me and ended up signing with them. The owner of the team back then was Bill DeWitt. And His son now is one of the owners in St. Louis, and Phil Segge was a farm director, and I'm trying to remember all the people that were there, but they were really good to me, and it was, looking back, a good team to sign with. I came up with the Reds in 1965, and of course that was a prelude to the Big Red Machine. But on that team was Pete Rose and Tony Perez and Frank Robinson and Veda Pinson and so many great players that went on to terrific careers.
Now you had a great minor league career with the Reds, Art. Starting in 60 with the Geneva Redlegs. Now, people might recognize the town of Geneva, upstate New York. You homered in your first at-bat up in Geneva. You were a roommate of Pete Rose. You were probably real familiar with Pete. You played minor league ball with him before you both came up to Cincinnati. You did some great things in the minor leagues. Also, Martin Digo Jr., you played with him. Were you aware that he was the son of the great Hall of Famer?
I wasn't at first, and then I found out that he was his son. And Marty Jr. was a really good ball player. That team was interesting because also on that team was Tony Perez, who was now in the Hall of Fame. But what's interesting about that team, it was in the New York Penn League, is that we were so bad as a team that we got our manager fired in the middle of the year. I'll never forget. His name was Reno DiBenedetto. And we were so bad, they replaced him and moved him someplace else. And a guy named Jack Cassini came in. And what's interesting about it, even though we were a bad team, the three of us went on to the big leagues. Tony, of course, had a great career. Pete, went on to have more hits than anybody in the history of the game. And myself, the three of us together probably didn't weigh 400 pounds. I mean, we were skinny kids, and we loved the game, and it was a good team. And during that time, the Reds were developing a lot of really good young players, and as witnesses, all the guys who went to the big leagues in subsequent years. But it's interesting, that team was the beginning for me, and Pete and I were very, very good friends. He came in June after he graduated high school, and to be perfectly honest, he really couldn't do anything well. He could run hard to first base after a walk, but he wasn't a good fielder. He wasn't a good hitter, and he didn't throw very well. They had him at second base, and the next year they kept him at Class D. They moved him down to, at that time, Cincinnati had two Class D teams, which was the lowest classification. They moved him to Tampa, Florida, and he played for Johnny Vandermeer, who was famous for throwing two consecutive no-hitters, back-to-back no-hitters, And Tony also played another year up in Geneva, and they moved me to Class B, Topeka, Kansas. And then we were all together in 1962 in Macon, Georgia, of all places, in the Sally League. And then the next year, Pete went to spring training with the Reds and wasn't on the roster. And the rest is history. He made the team, became Rookie of the Year, and went on to have the career he had. And of course, there's a lot of controversy about whether he should be in the Hall of Fame or not, but fact is, he had a brilliant career as a player in the big leagues.
He sure did. Yeah, and you're right about developing those players, Art. They were developing not only Perez, but they had guys like Darren Johnson and Lee May down there.
Jimmy Wynn also was
right.
A minor. Johnny Bench, Mel Queen, Tommy Helms, Tommy Harper. I mean, I can name a lot of guys who went on to the big leagues. And back then, when I signed, there was only 16 teams. It was so hard to get to the big leagues. And then they, of course, expanded in 1962, which opened up a little bit more room for some of these guys. And a guy like Jimmy Wynn moved on to the Houston Astros because there just wasn't room for him in the big leagues with the Reds. They were developing a lot of really good young players in the Cincinnati organization. And as witness, again, in the mid-70s, they were the Big Red Machine, which was a terrific baseball club. I mean, they were just a
definitely
awesome team back then.
And for folks who may not be familiar, the guy we spoke about, Martin Digo, his dad is in the Hall of Fame. Many people consider him, who saw him play, many people consider him to be the greatest ball player who ever lived. He's buried in Cuba. He's the only Cuban ball player in the Baseball Hall of Fame, but many think he's the greatest of all time.
Well, his son was a pretty good player. He could do a lot of things well. You know, it's interesting about guys, you see them playing in the minor leagues, and you just don't know what happens. The scouts sometimes see him play a bad game, or they get injured or something, and You know, there's no secret to making it to the big leagues. It's hard work, obviously, and you have to have some talent, but you also have to be in the right place at the right time and also stay healthy. And some guys I saw in the minor leagues who I thought were terrific players, just, you know, something happened to them. They got hurt, had a bad game, didn't rebound the next day, and they got scouts wrote a bad report about them, and they got buried because there just wasn't that many teams. But it's a little bit different now. There's a lot more teams, more opportunity, but Marty Jr. was a pretty good player. He just didn't pan out like his father.
Definitely. Now, you're famous for your four home runs. All right, let's talk about that a little bit. Take us through that August 12th and 14th of 1966. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it's really interesting. That year was quite a year for me. They had traded Frank Robinson over the winter and got a chance to play a lot more that year from the first year, obviously. And I think I didn't start the game. It was a Friday night against Pittsburgh, and I went in about the, I believe, the seventh or eighth inning in one of these pitcher-hitter switches where they change pitchers, put me in right field. So I was hitting in the pitcher spot in the bottom of the inning. We were behind a run. I hit a home run in the bottom of the eighth, I believe it was, and put us ahead in the ball game. Pittsburgh tied it up. We went in the extra innings and proceeded to hit two more home runs in extra innings. Now, you'd think if you hit two home runs in extra innings, your team's going to win the game, but turns out we lost that game. And I think I'm the only player in baseball history who's hit three home runs in a game and didn't start the game, wasn't in the starting lineup.
That's correct. Yeah, that's
kind of
that's
a strange
right.
stat to have on your side, but it is what it is. And then we get rained out the next day, and on the Sunday I come to the ballpark and I'm not in the starting lineup. One of the home runs was off a left-hand pitcher, and two were off righty, so it couldn't have been because the left-hander was pitching on Sunday, because it turned out it was Vernon Law who was pitching, a right-hander. So I pinch it in the fifth inning, I believe it was, and put us ahead with a home run in that game. We ended up losing that game also. So we had four home runs in a row, and we lost both the games, which is kind of really strange. And then we fly out to Los Angeles that night on Sunday, and then the next night I'm not in the starting lineup, which is really strange. I mean, it was one of these bizarre things that happens in your life that you can't explain. I wasn't one of these players that really would confront the manager at the time. When I look back on my career, I probably should have been a little bit different. I probably would have had much more success. But I accepted it. Dave Bristol was the manager. He sent me up to pinch hit in that game, and I singled the right field. And I ended up having about six or seven hits in a row. But it was just a really interesting time. And that particular year, I hit 21 home runs and only 230 at-bats, I believe, was the best ratio in the major league.
234, exactly. Yeah.
So it was a terrific ratio, but that 4 or 5 day period was just an interesting and bizarre period of my life. But the bats in the Hall of Fame, they asked me to, if I would have hit five in a row, they would have wanted the whole uniform and everything. But with just the four, the bats in the Hall of Fame, and I get a lot of people who visit Cooperstown and go into the hall and see it on display. It's quite an honor for me to have that on display there.
Sure is, yeah. Now, after that, Art, you come to New York for a guy named Bob Johnson before the 68 season. Originally, you're unhappy to come to the Mets.
Well, you know, it was not a good team.
Right.
It wasn't crazy about New York. Even though I grew up in a good-sized city, New York was really a big city and kind of intimidating, and was not a place that I really liked. And I got traded, and that's another interesting story. We have time. I'll briefly tell you about it. The general manager for the Mets was a guy named Bing Devine at the time, and he knew me when I was a kid growing up in St. Louis because he was, for a period of time, was the general manager of the Cardinals, but ended up with the Mets. But anyway, I was with the Reds, and I had just had gotten surgery on my back, and Bob Housen was a general manager, and he called, and I must have been a little bit out of my mind or whatever, because I thought he was calling to see how I was feeling, but he was calling to tell me that I got traded to the Mets. And so when the first time you get traded, it's always a little bit of culture shock, and that was a little bit of strange for me. And then all to hear about the Mets was a team that I wasn't really crazy about, but anyway, he said Mr. Devine was going to give me a call He did, and I knew him, and he was very nice to me, and he got through telling me how they've been trying to make this trade, and the Mets were an up-and-coming team, and I would really like playing there, and a lot of good information that made me feel better, and I was really happy after the call, but it turns out about 2 days later, I pick up the newspaper and see where Bing Devine left the Mets and came back to the Cardinals as general manager. So he had just got through telling me how great it was there, and now I'm with the team and don't know anybody. But as it turned out, '68 was an interesting year. Fell in love with the city. We weren't a good team. We finished ninth, a half game out of last place. That was still one division. They didn't go to two divisions till '69, but made a lot of great friends here in New York and was with wonderful teammates. And you could see that the team was on the cusp of being a pretty good team. Had great young pitching, good defense, and some pretty good hitters. And '68 was kind of a prelude to things, hopefully good things to come, and as it turned out, it was. But fell in love with the city once I got here, and I've been here ever since.
Exactly. We're speaking with Art Shamsky tonight. '69, you platoon with Ron Swoboda. How'd you feel about platooning with Ron?
I hated it.
Did you? Okay.
I must tell you, nobody likes it. But it was working. You know, Gil Hodges was the manager. Gil told you exactly what was on his mind. He was very honest, and it was what it was. It was successful for him in those five positions, I believe. But I don't think anybody really liked it. And you couldn't get into a groove. You couldn't. You get a few hits, and then you'd sit down, and you get back in, and it was just a difficult situation. And on top of that, you could never go in. You couldn't have agents back then. So when you wanted to try and make a few extra bucks at contract time, they would say to you, "Well, you didn't play against this person, you didn't play against this team, et cetera, et cetera." So it was difficult. And I remember I had a great playoff series against the Atlanta Braves that year, 7 hits and 13 at-bats, and we faced 3 right-hand pitchers and swept the Braves in the play. That was the first year of the playoffs. And
right.
The first game of the World Series, Mike Cuellar, a left-hand pitcher for Baltimore, is pitching, and I don't start the game, and Ronnie Swoboda starts the game. But what's interesting about it, Gil sent me up to pinch hit in the top of the ninth with the game on the line and against the left-hander, and it didn't bother me at all. Lefties never really bothered me, but I just thought it was interesting that he had enough confidence in me to send me up and pinch hit in that situation. But it was difficult. Platooning with somebody is always difficult. That particular year, though, he maximized all of us and got the best out of everybody, and to his credit, and that's part of managing, and that's why he was a great manager.
Yeah, he sure did, Art. You're exactly right. Let's talk about some of the games with the Chicago Cubs. They were certainly legendary that year in '69. Talk a little bit about Seaver's imperfect game.
Well, Tommy was just a terrific pitcher. I really very rarely saw him get hit hard, and if it was, it wasn't more than one game. I mean, he was always out there competing and pitching great almost every game. I know, looking back over history, he'll look back at that and wish he took that pitch back from Jimmy Quales. But it was a great game. He had great stuff, and as usual, and it was just a little flare to left center field. I mean, nobody could have made a play on it. And it was
no.
Just one of those things. And eventually, he would get his no hitter, but he was terrific as usual that night.
And how about the Black Cat? Where were you when the Black Cat came and crossed
well,
in front
Black
of Ron
Cat,
Santo?
I believe I was in right field, but the Black Cat, if I remember correctly, was so eerie that I can't even explain to you. But I will tell you this: if he would have come over to the R side of the dugout and I was in there and he stared at me, I would have freaked out. In my book, The Magnificent Seasons, about that year,
right.
Jets winning and us winning and Knicks winning in May of 70, I interviewed some of the guys on the Cubs and asked them about that, and Ferguson Jenkins told me he got really freaked out because that cat just walked around and just kind of walked by Ron Santo on the on-deck circle and just stared into the dugout, and I really believe he was staring at Leo DeRocher, too, which makes it even more strange.
Yeah.
But here's the really fascinating thing about that. Many years later, I interviewed Pete Flynn, who was on the ground crew that day, and I asked him about that cat. And I said to him, Pete, really, where was that cat, you know, before? And he said, I want to tell you something. I never saw that cat before, and I never saw the cat after that particular game. So I don't know if that's true or not, but that's the story I heard from one of the grounds crew.
Yeah.
So who knows? It was one of those years that things worked well for us, and that cat coming on the field went on the right side of the field looking back in retrospect now.
That's the stuff that legends are made of, Art. It's one of those things. It's amazing.
Well, they were always great games against the Cubs. I look back on those series we had against them with Ferguson Jenkins and Billy Hands and, you know, and Seaver and Coopman and all the guys. Those games were just great games. I particularly enjoyed the games in Chicago. I believe we were the team where the fans would start, would hit a home run, and the fans started throwing the ball back from the bleacher bums out there. So the rivalry really started, I believe, in 1969. And they had a really good team, the Cubs. And it wasn't so much that they blew it. It was just we just overran them. We were such a good ball club from the middle of August on that we were almost unbeatable. And looking back on those series and those games in Chicago and in New York, it was great times, great games, great players on both sides. It's just an incredible experience to have been part of it.
It certainly was. And I think Art, much like the Red Sox in 86, I don't think some people in Chicago have gotten over that yet.
Well, I don't think so either. I meet people who were around at that time, and even some people who weren't even born, much like I meet people today who in this area in New York City who weren't around but know about the 69 Mets from their parents or their grandparents. The legacy of that team is passed on. The Chicago Cubs of that 69 years passed on from generation to generation. If you go down their lineup, they had a terrific lineup and some good, really good starting pitching. They didn't have the relief pitching that maybe would have really gotten them over the hump, but they had a really terrific team. And, again, it wasn't so much that they blew it. It was the 69 Mets were, from, like I said, the middle of August on, we were just almost an unbeatable team playing outstanding baseball.
Exactly. Now, as we shift to the World Series, Art, Cleon Jones at the plate, Dave McNally pitching, ball skips in the dirt, supposedly hits Cleon in the foot, rolls into the dugout. What happens?
Well,
We have several opinions. We have Ron Swoboda talking about the bag of balls on the dugout floor. We have Jerry Kuzman telling us another little story.
If you know Gil Hodges, you can't imagine him ever doing anything that would be a little bit shady. So I just think he picked up the ball that came off the field and walked out to the umpire. What's interesting about it is Cleon didn't run right at first, which really makes it look like he didn't get hit.
Okay.
And Clendenin is on the on-deck circle and said, go to first, you know, run to first. And Cleon, to this day, says, oh, no, I felt good at the plate. I wanted to hit. So I'm thinking, you know, who knows who's telling the truth there. But as it turned out, he runs to first, and then Clendenin hits the home run. But that was such a turning point in the series. There's so many versions of what really happened, but I think Cleon is much like when he was playing left field and Gil walked out, take him off the field in that game against Houston. We were getting beaten a doubleheader, so really, there's only one person who really knows the truth, and you'd have to ask him. I've interviewed him and talked to him about it, and he says he did get hit by the pitch, and the leg was bothering him when Gil walked out the left field to bring him in. So I have to believe what he has to say.
All right, we'll go with that, Art. Unfortunately, I don't know if you talk about it that much. What people want to know about Art is everybody loves Raymond.
Well, it goes along with some of the crazy things in my career. The producer of that show was a big Mets fan, grew up in Flushing, and one of his favorite players was Art Shamsky. So he decided to name this bulldog Bulldog Shamsky, And I was on the show, and it was a great experience for me. I get so many people coming up to me and saying, you know the dog was named after you on Everyone Loves Raymond, and, you know, it's been on for 15 years. So
sure.
I think by now I do know there's a dog named Shamsky.
Exactly.
But what's interesting about it, it's this ugly bulldog that they neutered, and it's on the show, and so I have to explain that to people. But you know, it's part of the reason I've being part of the 69 Mets and all the things that I've done in my life. That was one thing, and having been on that show and people still remember you, it's quite a thrill for me. So I get a lot of people talking about it, and the reruns are still on, so that's great.
Tell us a little bit about the Israeli Baseball League and you and Kenny Holzman and Ron Bloomberg and your involvement in that, Art.
Well, the league started in 2007, and I got a call from a gentleman by the name of Larry Barris, who was starting the league, and he said, I'd like to talk to you about something. And I met him, and he said, I want to start a baseball league in Israel, and we'd like you to manage a team. And I said, no, you're crazy. I don't want to go there. I had never been there. There's problems. Baseball in Israel, I just don't think it's going to work. And we left it at that. And about 2 weeks later, he called me back, and he said, are you absolutely sure? And I said, I'm pretty sure. He said, look, meet me one more time. I want to talk to you about this. So I met him, and he said, look, we're going to have it's going to be a great league. We want you to be part of this thing and kind of develop the game. We're going to have state-of-the-art the fields, we're going to have scoreboards, concession stands, it's going to be great. So I second thought, I said, okay, I'll do it. And as it turned out, the fields were in lousy shape. There was no concession stands, and the scoreboards were people standing up on a ledge turning numbers upside down so you wouldn't even know what the score was.
Uh-oh.
But it was one of the best experiences of my life. I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed managing. It was relatively simple. They were seven-inning games, designated hitter. And I really kind of enjoyed dealing with the players. They were from all over the world. Each mm-hmm. team had two or three Israelis. The rest were from the United States, Canada, Australia, Europe. And the baseball itself was not very good. The fields were not very good. Quality of the game wasn't very good, but I really enjoyed it. It was a great experience, met a lot of wonderful people, learned about a lot about the state of Israel and learned a lot about the Palestinians and some of their problems, and it was a great experience for me, and I look back on it. Unfortunately, the league itself only went 1 year, but it was the precursor for Israel trying to make it to the World Baseball Classic. They tried and fielded a team in 2012 and did not make it. They lost in a qualifying round, but they're serious about the game there, and hopefully they can raise some money, develop the game. They have to build some fields and stuff, but I'm very proud of being able to go over there and take part of it. And I've gone back and done some clinics, and it was just a wonderful experience for me to be part of it.
Outstanding. Well, for you folks who may not know, Art has an amazing book out. It's called The Magnificent Seasons. It chronicles the New York Mets, the Knickerbockers, and the Jets championship seasons, all in 1969-70. Please check that out. Go to artshamsky.com. Art is available to speak. Correct, Art?
Yeah, I do a lot of appearances, Bill, and people can follow me on Twitter if they like also, but they can go to the website if they're interested in the book, and I have some other things on there. But I do a lot of appearances being part of that 69 team. You know, it's interesting. I played 13 years professionally, and really nobody ever talks about the other 12. It's just about the 69 Mets.
Yeah.
Every day somebody here, I live in New York City, and every day somebody talks to me about that team. They want to know about the Black Cat or Seaver's almost perfect game or all the things that you ask, all those interesting questions, people still want to know about it. They want to know about the dog. Everyone loves Raymond. They want to know about the book. They want to know about Israel. You ask all the great questions. So for me, being part of that team, I get a lot of questions of, you know, who was the toughest pitcher, this and that. How about Pete Rose, you know, and don't you wish you were playing baseball right now? And, of course, I want to say yes. I wish I was making the money they're making now, but the reality of it, I wouldn't trade it for the World Series ring that I have from that team. And being part of that 69 team was so special. But also, I got a chance to play what I believe, and I think this is going to be thinking about doing this for my next book, is that I think the 1960s, particularly from 63 on to 69, you had the greatest conglomerate of players in the history of the game. And a lot of people might argue with me now thinking players today are the best ever, but the reality of it is, I got a chance to play with and against some of the greatest players, including Willie Mays, Henry Aaron, Roberto Clemente, Frank Roberts, Pete Rose, Johnny Bench, Marichal, Gibson, Koufax, Drysdale, Seaver, Ferguson Jenkins, Stargell, Billy Williams, McCovey, I mean, Gaylord Perry, Steve Carl. I mean, go on and on with names. And these are just guys in the National League. So that question that people ask me, don't you wish you were playing now, it really has two answers. One is, yes, I wish I was playing, making the money. But the reality of it is I wouldn't trade it for the life I led and part of that 69 team and part of that era where the players were so great. And for me to be part of it was just something I can't even explain to people because it was such a thrill for me.
Outstanding, Art. Well, I tell you, it's been an honor and a pleasure talking with you, Art, about your career and about the Miracle Mets. We'll come back and talk to you about that book, hopefully. Thanks for taking the time out of your Sunday night to talk with us.
All right, great. Thank you so much.
Take care. The great Art Shamsky, ladies and gentlemen. Up next, we'll talk to the great former Houston Astro pitcher, J.R. Richard, on Sports Talk 1240. Stay with us, folks.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you can find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you. Hope you had a great weekend on this beautiful one, weather-wise here in the New York area, and that you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Waiting to get James Rodney Richard on the telephone. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Art Shamsky. He really did a great job talking about the 1969 Miracle Mets, and had so much more to ask Art, but we unfortunately ran out of time. Wanted to ask him more about Gil Hodges, more about his managerial style, more about Seaver, Kuzman, about Nolan Ryan. Amazing talking about those Cub games back in 1969, about the Black Cat, about the crowd singing Goodbye Leo to Leo DeRocher, about the National League Championship Series, which was the first NLCS. The pitching turned out to be the name of the game back then. It was supposed to be the pitching. It turned out to be a hitter's series. back then in 1969. And Art Shamsky started all three games of the NLCS. He batted 538, led all hitters in batting average during that. And I really wanted to ask him how he felt during the World Series when Don Buford led off with the home run in Game 1 off Tom Seaver. But we didn't get a chance. He was traded, by the way, by the New York Mets in 1971, I believe in the fall of 1971, with Jim Bibby, Rich Folkers, and Charlie Hudson to the St. Louis Cardinals in exchange for Jim Beauchamp, Chuck Taylor, and Harry Parker. That was October 18th, 1971. Great talking about Everybody Loves Raymond. Everybody wanted to know about that, about the Everybody Loves Raymond episode with the 1969 New York Mets. And you should really check out Art's book, Magnificent Seasons, chronicling all three championship seasons that year in 1969-70 about the New York Mets, the New York Jets, and the New York Knickerbockers. Nothing, Brian, yet? No word on James Rodney Richard yet. Talk a little bit about his career. He from 76 to 80, he was one of the premier pitchers in the majors. He led the National League twice in strikeouts, once in earned run average, three times in hits allowed per nine innings, winning at least 18 games between 1976 and 79. It was July 30th, 1980. He suffered a stroke and collapsed while playing. They would think he was just playing a game of catch before one of the Astros games. And they rushed him to the hospital for emergency surgery to remove a blood clot in his neck. That condition, it brought a sudden end to his career at the age of 30, only 30 years old. And his 313 strikeouts in 1979, that still is an Astros franchise record. And he held the team record for career strikeouts, 1493, until 1987, until it was broken by one Nolan Ryan. He was a National League All-Star in 1980. That's J.R. Richard. Still nothing on the telephone from him. I think we want to go to a break, Brian. We'll go to a break, and we'll be right back to Sports Talk 1240, folks, right after this.
Dear John, I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is serious, and I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to when you checked on me? I don't want to leave. But remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart. Don't let it quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range today. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
Do you worry about how much someone else drinks? Do you ever ride in a car with a driver who has been drinking? Al-Anon family groups are for relatives and friends affected by someone else's drinking. Are you troubled by someone else's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group from people just like you. For more information, go to Al-Anon.org or call 1-888-4-Al-Anon to find an Al-Anon meeting near you.
WGBB has time slots available for anyone who wants to host their own radio show, 516-623-1240. You've probably just asked yourself, well, what kind of show could I do? Well, let me ask you, what are you passionate about? Is it books, cooking, music? How about health and wellness? Or maybe you enjoy learning and talking about history, current events. Interview others in their related fields. 516-623-1240. You can host a show at a station that's been a part of our community for over 80 years. And our knowledgeable staff will be more than happy to assist you. Be heard on the internet, www.am1240wgbb.com. So what do you say? I say call Jeff or Trevor, 516-623-1240. Be the producer. Host your own radio program, 516-623-1240. WGBB, the station that serves your community.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240. Doesn't look like we're going to hear from J.R. Richards, so I'm going to tell you a little bit more about his career until we're still going to try to reach him on the telephone. Played his entire career with the Houston Astros. He was selected by the Astros as the second pick in the first round of the 1969 amateur draft. From the time he made his major league debut with the Astros in 71 until 75, he had a limited role as an Astros pitcher, throwing no more than 72 innings in a season. In 75, Richard played his first full season in the majors as a starting pitcher. From 76 to 80, he was one of the premier pitchers in the majors, leading the National League twice in strikeouts, once in earned run average, and three times in hits allowed per nine innings. A little wild, winning at least 18 games between 1976 and 1979. On July 30th, 1980, he suffered a stroke and collapsed while playing a game of catch before an Astros game. He was rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery to remove a life-threatening blood clot in his neck. His condition brought a sudden end to his major league career at the age of 30. His 313 strikeouts in 1979 remains an Astros franchise record. He held the team's record for career strikeouts 1493 until 1987, as I said, until it was broken by Nolan Ryan. In 1981, Richard attempted a comeback with the Astros, but this failed because the stroke had slowed down his reaction time and it weakened his depth perception. He spent the next few seasons in the minor leagues before being released by the Astros in 1984. After his professional baseball career ended, Richard became involved in unsuccessful business deals and went through two divorces, which led him to being homeless and destitute in 1994. He found relief in a local church and later became a Christian minister. He entered Major League Baseball with the Astros in 1971 as a September call-up. On September 5th, he made his Major League debut at just 21 years of age. In the second game of a doubleheader against the San Francisco Giants, Richard used his fastball-slider combination to pick up the win and tied Carl Spooner's 17-year-old Major League record for striking out 15 batters in his first Major League start. Richard was charged with two earned runs and seven hits in the 5-3 Astros win, but struck out Willie Mays and Dick Dietz three times. Richard made his next start after 5 days' rest against the Cincinnati Reds, who would later finish the NL West season in a tie for fourth place with the Astros. Richard gave up a leadoff home run to Pete Rose in the first inning and pitched five innings of a two-hit, one-run game. He struck out five batters but walked six. Richard struggled in his two following starts. In a September 16th matchup against the Astros' division rival, the third-place Atlanta Braves, Richard pitched seven innings and surrendered four runs on seven hits. He struck out nine batters and even struck out the side in the first inning, but also walked four batters. Furthermore, he threw two wild pitches in the first and fifth innings. In his final game of the season against the Giants, Richard was replaced in the first inning after pitching to only four batters. I always had a problem with wildness. In and out of the minors, during the first next few seasons, Richard split time between the minors and the majors and did not become a regular starter with the Astros until 1975. After his cup of coffee with the Astros in 1971, Richards was sent down to Class AAA baseball to work on his pitching with the Oklahoma City 89ers for the 1972 season. He started 19 games with the 89ers before being called back up to the Astros. In AAA baseball in the American Association, Richard Fish finished with 10 wins and 8 losses in 128 innings of work. His 3.02 ERA was slightly higher than that of the previous season, but he maintained approximately the same walks per nine-inning ratio that he had the previous year. He recorded six complete games and finished with 169 strikeouts for a ratio of 11.88 strikeouts per nine innings. Richard re-entered the majors, starting a day-night doubleheader for the Astros against the San Diego Padres on July 30, 1972. He struggled and took the 10-7 loss. Richard did not pitch again until 2 weeks later when he entered in relief for Ken Forsch in the fifth inning to keep the Giants limited to a one-run lead. In two innings of relief, Richard gave up one hit, struck out three batters, and garnered the win. In his two final relief appearances of the season, Richard gave up five earned runs in just over one inning of work. He finished the season with a 13.50 ERA in only six innings of work and was again sent back down to AAA, this time with the Astros-affiliated Denver Bears. Richard started eight games with the Bears in 1973 and posted minor league career worse in ERA and hits allowed per nine innings. Despite his poor performance with the Bears, Richard was again called up by the Astros. Richard entered in the fourth inning of a June 16th game against the St. Louis Cardinals and his idol Bob Gibson. He pitched four innings of one-run ball and three innings of two-hit game in his next relief outing. Afterwards, the Astros placed Richard in the starting rotation, and he made his first major league start since July 30th of the previous year. He pitched six solid innings of one-run ball game and struck out six while walking three batters. Richard would make his next start 4 days later. Richard again pitched more than six innings but earned no decision after the Astros' bullpen gave up nine runs during the bottom of the ninth inning. After starting a July 4th game against the Braves, which he won, Richards was sent to the bullpen to add Tom Griffin into the Astros' starting rotation. He made three relief appearances against the Montreal Expos before making a start against the Los Angeles Dodgers on July 27th. 4 days later, Richard threw his first shutout against the Dodgers, in which he gave up just five hits and struck out nine batters. 19 days later, Richard pitched another complete game, this time giving up two runs while striking out nine. And walking three batters. He concluded the season with six wins and two losses in 16 games, 10 of which he started, and finished with 4.00 ERA and struck out 75 batters in 72 innings. He walked 38 batters, giving him a ratio of 4.75 walks per nine innings, which was lower than the ratio he had in his two previous minor league seasons. Despite his improved performance in the 1973 season, Richard was sent down to work on his pitching mechanics and ball control in Class AA baseball with the Columbus Astros of the Southern League. He started 13 games with Columbus before being moved back up to the Class AAA with the Denver Bears. In four starts with the Bears, Richard threw three shutouts and pitched 33 scoreless innings with a 4.0 record and 26 strikeouts. He was called back to the majors on July 13th and stayed with the Astros for the remainder of the season. He pitched 14 innings of baseball and six relief appearances before being placed on the starting rotation. He then started in all nine games of the season he pitched during the remainder of the season. Richard finished with a 4.18 ERA and just over 64 innings of work during the 15 pitching appearances he made during the season. Even though Richard's statistics showed he bounced between Houston and the minors during his first 4 years with the Astros due to his wildness, he often told reporters that racism played a role in keeping him from becoming a regular with the big club sooner. In the offseason, the Astros traded starting pitcher Claude Osteen to the Cardinals and lost starting pitcher Don Wilson, who died from carbon monoxide poisoning, some say suicide, at the age of 29 on January 5, 1975. As a result, Richard entered the 1975 season as the third starter of the Astros' pitching rotation, behind veterans Larry Durker and Dave Roberts. Richard was scheduled to start on April 9th versus the Braves. He was removed from the game in the fifth inning after jamming his toe on the first base bag but gave up no earned runs in his start. Richard continued to exhibit wildness as shown when he issued eight walks in both his third and fourth starts of the season. He followed by pitching a complete game win against the San Diego Padres on April 29th. The following start, he walked a career-high 11 batters in just six innings of pitching and also gave up seven runs in the Astros' 12-8 win over the Giants. By the All-Star break, Richard had 6 wins and 4 losses with a 4.93 ERA and just over 98 innings of work. In an August 10th game against the Pittsburgh Pirates, Richard yielded just 1 hit in 6 innings but walked 10 batters. He rebounded with a complete game shutout against the New York Mets 8 days later. Richard ended the season on a strong note by winning 3 of his last 4 starts, including his final 2 games against the Dodgers. He finished the year with a 12-10 record for the Astros, who finished with a franchise-worst 64-97 record. Richard was the only starter on the Astros pitching staff who had a winning record for the season. He led the team with 176 strikeouts, which is also the 5th highest in the National League. Richard also led the league in walks allowed and wild pitches thrown, with 138 and 20, respectively. During his breakout season, Richard entered the 1976 season as the pitching staff ace and took over Larry Durker's position as the opening day starter for the Astros. In his first start of the season, Richard gave up 4 runs in 4 innings against the defending World Series champion Cincinnati Reds on April 8th. He followed this inauspicious beginning with wins in 5 of his next 6 decisions. One of them included a 10-inning shutout effort that led to a 16-inning 1-0 Astros victory against the Dodgers. By the end of May, however, Richard was sitting even with a 5-5 record, loser of 4 straight decisions. He closed the first half of the season by winning a 10-inning shutout against the Mets on July 6th and an 8-inning start against the Expos 4 days later. At the All-Star break, Richard had a 9-9 record with a 2.88 ERA in over 153 innings of work. From July 10th to August 31st, Richard racked up 8 complete games, including 1 shutout, and he improved his record from 9-9 to 16-13. He pitched 98 innings and yielded only 22 earned runs, which gave him an ERA of 2.02 during the approximately 50-day span. On August 26th, Richard hit his first home run of the season during the second inning of the game. In his last game of the season on October 2nd, Richard pitched a complete game, 13 strikeout performance, and he also hit a 2-run home run in the 6th inning. Richard finished the season with a 20-15 record, 14 complete games, 3 shutouts, and 214 strikeouts in 219 innings of work. At age 26, Richard became the second pitcher in Astros history after Durker in 1969 to record 20 wins in a season, tying him 4th in the National League that year. Richard also became the 9th member of the Black Aces, an organization founded by Mudcat Grant that consists of all African-American pitchers who have won at least 20 major league games in a season. He was named the most valuable player of the Astros by the Houston chapter of the Baseball Writers Association of America. Richard finished 17th in the most valuable player voting and 7th in the National League Cy Young Award voting. His 2.75 ERA was the 7th best among the league's starting pitchers, and he held hitters to a 0.212 batting average. He led the league in lowest number of hits allowed per 9 innings and walks allowed. Richard also finished the season 2nd in batters faced, innings pitched, and games started. In addition, he led all National League pitchers with 14 hits, 2 home runs, and 9 runs batted in as a hitter. However, during the year, he committed 10 errors and finished with an 0.853 fielding percentage, nearly 100 lower than the league average. 1977, Richard began the season on a high note, with a 9-inning, 7-strikeout performance on April 8th against the Braves. He pitched 7 complete game victories in the first half of the season. By the All-Star break, Richard had 9 wins and 6 losses in over 116 innings of work, accompanied by 119 strikeouts and a 2.69 ERA. We're going to skip now to his comeback attempt after the stroke. In 1981, Richard underwent a rehabilitation program with the aim of recovering from the effects of the stroke. He trained with the Astros and the Texas Southern University team, participating regularly in pitching and batting practice with both towards the end of the season. After pitching in a few simulated games, Richard was placed on the 40-man active roster on September 1, 1981. Astros manager Bill Verdon thought Richard was not ready to return, so Richard did not pitch with the team during the last 2 months of the season. In the following year, Richard pitched in a single spring training game and then went into extended spring training in Sarasota, Florida during the first 2 months of the season. There he registered 3 wins and 2 losses and a 3.38 ERA and 7 starts for 32 total innings. Afterwards, he joined the Major League's rehabilitation program with the Daytona Beach Astros in the Florida State League. In 6 starts, Richard notched 3 wins, 2 complete games, and posted a 2.79 ERA. He was then promoted to the AAA baseball with the Tucson Toros of the Pacific Coast League. He struggled to control the ball, conceding a high number of runs to opposing teams. He took a loss on August 12th against the Phoenix Giants and on August 27th against the Salt Lake City Gulls in a 13-0 rout. His longest outing as a starter, more than 5 innings, was an appearance against the Giants in the last game of the season on September 1st. He then joined the Astros' extended roster but did not play in any games. In 1983, Richard started to complain of pain in his left calf. The synthetic graft inserted in his July 1980 surgery had closed off, which meant that he needed a surgical bypass in his left leg. Richard was granted free agency by the Astros on November 7, 1983, but the Astros still had faith in him, so he was re-signed on February 17 the following year. Just a little over 2 months later, he was released by the Astros, thus ending his baseball career. Despite an almost complete recovery, the risk of future complications was so great that he never pitched again. His final major league record was 107-71 with 1493 strikeouts and a 3.15 ERA in 238 games and 1,606 innings. Nolan Ryan broke his Astros record for career strikeouts in 1987. After baseball, after his career ended, he returned to Louisiana. He invested in some business ventures, which failed. By 1995, he was eligible for his baseball pension. He played in an old-timers game. In the following months, he spent many nights under the overpass at Highway 59 and Beechnut Road in Houston. He was homeless. He turned to the New Testament Church in Houston. He sought help from his minister. He always believed that God was on his side. He started working at an asphalt company, and he returned to the church as a minister. J.R. became involved in the Houston community, working with the local financial donors to help establish baseball programs for children. It resurrected his baseball career and also JR's life after baseball. So that's probably where he stands right now. We hope to bring JR to you some night in the future, but I really apologize that we couldn't bring him to you tonight. I'll try to find out what happened, and that's about it. I thank you for joining us. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I would like to thank my guest, Art Shamsky, and I'd like to thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for a replay of this show, and I'll be back with you Sunday, June 28th, with His Honor Jeff Katz, the mayor of Cooperstown. We're going to be discussing his new book called Split Season. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.